You've worked hard to build your brand, so why settle for one-size-all-fits branded clothing? Lands' End Outfitters creates apparel your employees will truly want to wear that unites your team in comfort and style. It's why Lands' End Outfitters has been a branded apparel supplier to some of the world's most respected brands for more than 30 years. From logo polos to fully customized branded wardrobes, our world-class outfitters will partner with you to help your team feel confident on the job and put your brand into action, all backed by above and beyond expertise. See why Lands' End Outfitters should be your branded apparel partner. Go to business.landsend.com/pod20 and use code pod20 for 20% off your first product. That's business.landsend.com/pod20. Code pod20 for 20% off your first product.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Sky, proud partner and supporter of the Republic of Ireland Women's National Football Team.
This is News Talk.
Now, welcome along to the football show. So Tom English of BBC Scotland is going to join us later on because tomorrow Celtic host Rangers in the Scottish Premiership. They can overtake Rangers in the table if they win. They've had a very good couple of weeks and Postecoglou is very popular and Van Bronckhorst is starting to just meet some trouble at Rangers here and there. So Tom English will talk to us about all aspects of that game tomorrow. It is the first evening midweek Old Firm Derby in 11 years, the last one 11 years ago, known in Scotland as the Shame Game. And scenes so apparent, apparently, that it went all the way to Parliament and there was an act brought in around football matches. Ali McCoist, Neil Lennon certainly squaring up to each other. El Hadji Diouf was on the scene then. So maybe it was much ado about nothing. I think the act was subsequently quashed, but there was an initial very strong reaction and all hell broke loose. So first time in 11 years we'll have lights and evening kickoff and it's at Parkhead, although there won't be any Rangers fans there effectively. That standoff is still very much in place between the two clubs, so no away fans really, as opposed to the days when 6,000-7,000 away fans were at these respective games. That is on the way with Tom English. Arthur O'Dea still in studio. Hello.
How are you?
Ronan Mullen with us as well. Hello.
Hey lads.
How you doing? So we were chatting away in our production call earlier on and somebody, and once it was mentioned, I knew we couldn't then not talk about it, so my heart sank. Somebody said, and I kid you not, listeners, it's the 17th, that's 1-7. I mean, what's that known as, colloquially?
The famous 17th anniversary.
But the Golden Jubilee, I don't know. But anyway, it's the 17th anniversary of, and I thought, 17th anniversary. I was like, what could this be? Why would you? It must be something big if we're bringing up 17th. Nothing occurred to me. 17th anniversary of Roy Keane and Patrick Vieira in the tunnel at Highbury. And I thought, my God, we're actually going to talk about this on the radio tonight, aren't we? So I blame you two. Collectively, I wash my hands of this and blame you two. This just shows the effect of Roy Keane, that here we are 17 years later, Ronan, marking ultimately an innocuous moment in a tunnel. Although still, of all the moments in any tunnel anywhere in world sports, still the moment I think we all remember most vividly.
Yeah, I think myself and Arthur have a logbook of Premier League years episodes and some highlights that come from them, and typically Roy Keane is central to them. You know, those were heady days, Joe, where Irish players were dominating the top end of the Premier League, so we shouldn't forget them so quickly. But no, it's a very interesting game, and something that we discussed earlier also was the fact that by this stage of the season in question, like, Chelsea had very much become the coming force and were en route to a walk-away Premier League title win. Jose Mourinho was in his absolute pomp, fresh from the Champions League win with Porto, and rocked up the Premier League in seamless fashion. And with all that going on in the background, Manchester United and Arsenal played out one of the greatest Premier League games of all time. I saw a few people describing it as the best. I think there have actually been a few contenders in the last 5 years when football seems to have gone up another notch in terms of intensity and pace. So recency bias notwithstanding, there have been some cracking developments in that regard. But I think the peak of the Man United rivalry on footballing terms was probably that 1999 FA Cup replay.
Yeah.
And that was one of the games that we were all treated to during lockdown when they were replaying games. And that, like, speaking of the likes of these Man City, Liverpool games of recent years, that could live with it in terms of pace and quality. So this is an interesting moment in time, as we were saying, that the rivalry is still very much at its peak in terms of the personalities involved, but the quality might just be going over the edge ever so slightly.
No, You're right. It is tempting to remember that as the peak and the high watermark of the rivalry. But as you say, as Ronan says, Arthur, Chelsea are on course at that stage to walk to the title with a record breaking at the time. It was unthinkable, 95 points, 12 points clear of Arsenal. Manchester United back on 77 points. So 18 points behind Chelsea. And that was an increasingly troubled and poor Manchester United. Within the calendar year, Keane would be gone and Ferguson would be booed at Old Trafford after a Villarreal match, and things weren't great around then. So it is tempting to remember it as the peak of the rivalry. Actually, it was definitely heading back down the mountain at that stage.
Yeah, and it's interesting, I suppose, in hindsight, a little bit you can judge where both are going. It's interesting, like, we're probably being a little bit unfair on Arsenal, I suppose. They're coming off the back there of their invincible season.
They do get to a Champions League final the following year,
yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah. Whereas Man United, I suppose, with the likes of very young Rooney, very young Ronaldo and stuff, they're kind of in the emergence of another rebirth. I do appreciate, though, your general point of just almost any excuse. It's an amazing sort of situation with Keane and United. And
did you watch it live? Do you remember it?
I did. I think I watched it at my friend's house. I remember it. I'm fairly certain it was midweek, almost certainly, and it was it did have, I think even before that, it had the feel of a very big game for whatever reason.
Well, I guess whoever wanted to even have a hope of catching Chelsea probably needed to win. I'd say that was the context. I certainly remember it, and it was so spectacular and unbelievable and surreal, and I can't believe this is happening. I mean, it was amazing.
And it was. I mean, it's one of the best, or one of was one of just the best grounds under lights to watch a game at Highbury. There was just, like, it just,
and that tunnel was snug.
It was very tight
to the drama. You've got Arsenal, you've got Manchester United, you've got Graham Powell, you've got a cameraman.
You really did fall together perfectly.
It was magical. Here, so we had a sense of the audio, and you won't decipher a word of it, really. I mean, I think everybody remembers it, so we don't need to play that. So certainly Roy Keane had a really good game and was interviewed post-match by Jeff Shreves 17 years ago.
It looked like you and Patrick Vieira were trading insults and threats in the tunnel beforehand. What happened?
Don't want to go into too much detail, but Patrick Vieira is 6'4" and starts having a go at Gary Neville. He says, come and have a go at me. Simple as that.
Do you feel battle lines were drawn before you even went on the pitch?
Well, if players want to intimidate some of my teammates, then let's have a go at some of the other players. They think Gary Neville's an easy target, but I wasn't having it.
I mean, the obvious point to make here is they're pretty much exactly the same height.
Oh, God. It's so harsh.
Is that the point of saying pick on someone your own size?
Like, it's so harsh. It's just, I wonder, what was his intention? I don't know what you think. Like,
Keane's.
Yeah, he wasn't trying to do down Gary Neville, presumably.
He did a good job.
But it's just so brutal.
So we had them, obviously, at a roadshow a couple of years ago and couldn't not ask about their memories at the moment. So first off, Roy Keane and the Highbury tunnels. I can't remember. I think we brought this up pretty much at the top. I think this came up near the start. I think we even made a joke about the height thing, and like, you're basically the same height. So here's Roy Keane anyway. I haven't heard this since. So Roy Keane and his memory of the Highbury tunnel incident.
Do you know what? That always looks worse than what it really was. Honestly, it wasn't. I don't think it was as bad as that.
You were right. You touch on it in your book, obviously, and you say that initially Vieira had been talking to Gary, and you came back into the dressing room and you sort of said, what's going on here? And you said, Roy, I was busy G'ing myself up in a camway. The last thing I wanted was Gary in my ear hole going, they've been shouting at me in the tunnel. My attitude was, deal with it. You're not 11. So what changed from Gary in your ear hole, it's a great word, to you, something about Vieira and what was going on obviously clicked?
Yeah, but Gary was like that before every game. It would be a bit like twitchy and nervous, and and the problem with the Arsenal lads that time, people look back on my career, I wasn't really into that argy-bargy stuff in the tunnels and threatening people. Honestly, it wasn't my scene. Jesus, listen out. I wasn't, but when I see lads then having almost picking on somebody, and I don't mean just on Nev, there was three or four of them, Martin Keown and people like that. So that probably, it was more the bullying than kind of fellas getting stuck into each other on the pitch. I think if you have any argo with people, you bring it all onto the pitch, this tunnel stuff. And the most important thing about that night was, and maybe forgotten about, is that we had to win the game, and we won the game. Yeah. It's no point doing all this carry on in the tunnel and then going out and get beaten. So the key was to win the match, and just put Arsenal, one or two lads in their place. But that was no big deal.
I'm sure it happens plenty. It's just the cameras were there. That's the issue.
Of course. Again, honestly, I thought it looked probably a lot worse than what it was.
It's weird. The old crowd laugh when he's trying to sincerely downplay something. I do think that's around the time as well, though, where the unbeatable run ends and he absolutely, sincerely did not like Keown crashing his elbow into Van Nistelrooy after the penalty miss. I think that was in the ether as well.
Yeah, because the reverse fixture of that season was the Arsenal going for their 50th consecutive win. And I don't know if you recall that game in any great detail, lads, but United's tactics were a little bit over the borderline, you might say. I think Andrew Mangan is one who would routinely post that compilation of the tackles that Reyes in particular was on the end of from, I think there was a double act from Phil Neville and possibly Darren Fletcher, but there was a couple of them in it, you know, this whole coordinated tackling so you don't pick up bookings. So like Phil Neville, and I think Van Nistelrooy left one in on Ashley Cole. It was a really, really grubby game, and Arsenal, like, so out of character for that team, capitulated really under the pressure. Like they took the bait in a big way, and United managed to almost win the psychological battle, and that was borne out in the scoreline ultimately. The goal, I think, was Van Nistelrooy penalty, and then a breakaway goal at the end from Rooney, I believe. So that those were two extraordinary games. So that was a precursor for what came at Highbury, and the 4-2 was absolutely magnificent. And talking about Irish players, John O'Shea's lob was just iconic.
I mean, it's the most surprised I've ever seen a human being look. It's quite a thing to see a human being that surprised in a goal celebration. So Gary Neville, obviously, at the roadshow as well. So he had listened to King give his side of things there. So here's Gary Neville's recollection.
So before we got in the tunnel to go out for the game, coming in for the warm-up, he's chasing me up the tunnel, screaming at me. So I goes into the changing room and sits down next to Dennis Irwin and said, you know, Vieira's a bit annoyed. he's just basically chased me up the tunnel. And obviously I sat next to Dennis here and Roy was next to Dennis. So Roy...
And you obviously heard that.
Yeah, but to be honest, I was trying to mind my own business. Honestly, I was just focused on the game, you know, quite calm, getting in the zone. And Gary was a little bit upset and he seemed a bit worried.
In his ear hole. That's on ITV with Mark Pugic and Gary Neville and Roy Keane there together. You, Arthur, blew my mind with a great revelation here. Great spot.
Well, it seems very obvious. Like, so Dennis Irwin had left the club, I think, 3 years earlier. Which is an amazing thing with just the memory of it.
Like, doesn't it show how unreliable our memories are? Like, the way Neville talks there, you can feel him imagining seeing Dennis Irwin. It's like he can still see Dennis Irwin in his mind's eye. And Dennis, he's gone 3 years then?
Right, like, I think, and he was retired already. Like, it was just, and what's so interesting, he mentioned it two or three times.
Oh yeah, the Irwin thing is almost the anchor for the whole memory.
Which is just, it's remarkable, because I don't know, I'm sure that information is out there, but I suppose Keane probably must have sat beside Irwin, maybe, regularly enough. But, it's one of those, it's an incredible little, I suppose, nugget of information, as you're sent into memory. Because we think, thinking back, like, we have a pretty good recollection of that. But, I mean, when you're there, and maybe it all just blend into one, but, like, surely they were kind of prepped, you had plenty of time to think about it. It was him, Vieira and Keane there that day, talking about it, going through the whole thing. And it's just, I don't know, I suppose it blends in, but I suspect they're even a little bit guilty, perhaps, of thinking back that it was a bigger deal then in the grander scheme of things than it was.
The Man United team that evening was Roy Carroll in goal, Gary Neville right back, Ferdinand and Sylvester centre-halves. The Dennis Irwin imitator that night was Gabriel Heinze. So did Neville say it to Gabriel Heinze?
I don't think so.
I think he would have been utterly nonplussed by the whole situation. In fact, I don't think Vieira would have picked on Gabriel Heinze, put it that way.
No. In fact, Heinze might have done something about it. Fletcher played that night. Keane scores, Ronaldo, Rooney, Giggs, Saha came off the bench. And then for Arsenal, they had Almunia in goal, Lauren Campbell, Saigon, I've forgotten about him totally, Cole, Lundberg, Flamini, Vieira, obviously, Pires, Bergkamp, Henry. God, they were still very good.
There's the great image in the tunnel. I just always of Pascal Saigon really trying to calm Vieira down, the hands on the shoulders. Just like, don't get sucked into it, you're fine. I think Bergkamp comes down then, tries to do the same thing.
Graeme Poole talked about it and he was saying that Roy Keane was a strong, strong player. He would dominate his own team as well as the opposition, therefore the referee as well, just by sheer will. He would never try and con you or cheat you. There was just something about him, an almost immovable force about Roy that you just thought, bloody hell. And he was scary. That's Graeme Pohl talking about Roy Keane. And it was it exemplified, you know, all the quickness of thought of Keane. Like, he had been reading something in the programme notes about Patrick Vieira and his charity work in Africa. And, you know, just like, when it's required under the greatest pressure, that Rolodex of insults, boom, 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 perfect one, bang. And he's calling him a nice guy. And if you're so nice, why don't you go home and play for them? It's like, did you read that and store it knowing you'd need it? Or does it just come as like lightning bolt inspiration, Ronan? I don't know.
I don't know. It's just, he's just incredible. And the clip from the, like, in retrospect, some of his post-match interviews, you know, are up there with anything you'd see from the vault. You know, like, he put some amazing stuff on tape. And then latterly, you know, that roadshow we did a couple of years ago was before he became the media behemoth that he's become. You know, he's still in between, like, coaching management jobs, and possibly was, those were still his primary pursuits, in his own head at least. But, you know, as it's transpired, and possibly in no small part to his... successful some of the stuff from that roadshow became. Like, Sky obviously picked up on it and thought, geez, this guy can really...
Where did Pugach and ITV think to have that chat, I wonder?
You greased the wheels for this job.
So, there's just... as much as this was possibly a small enough jumping off point, it's just such a fascinating moment in time, like that that rivalry and where the two teams are at currently. You know, geez, it's been quite a low ebb for both clubs the last decade or so. So, I think... The other notable thing, there isn't really a comparable rivalry on the horizon yet. You know, if anything, it's between the managers for the most part.
Yeah, it's,
you know,
over with the players. They're all mates.
Yeah, there's some sort of, like, there's a bit of tetchiness between Klopp and Guardiola on a competitive level. I don't think they dislike each other as people by any means. And then Tuchel's somewhere in the mix. He's a combustible character. And at least we've got Antonio Conte back. But Mourinho was obviously a big addition to the whole thing and hyped up tensions big time around 2005. And just don't have that kind of drama at the moment.
Yeah, maybe it half explains some of that tetchiness around then in the tunnel in Highbury. The Mourinho factor was also not helping anyone's mood.
I'd say absolutely not. Especially, it was Arsenal's moment. This was their time. They, like, if Chelsea don't enter the equation, they take 2-3 titles. It's no problem, really. I mean, it's not, you have to look back. I mean, I'm wary of my own memory, like, on how, you know, where other teams are at that stage. But, you know, just by virtue of the fact, like, how much they dominated in 03-04.
Yeah.
And then it is interesting, as Rona mentioned it there, like, that, I do recall that other match that they lost at United to end their unbeaten run was, that felt like a kind of something had switched for them, because it was...
Pizzagate, isn't it? And Rooney's...
Oh, you could be right,
Rooney,
yeah,
winning the penalty, and Sol Campbell...
Yeah, and it just...
Rightly saying Rooney dived.
Yeah. Was, and even all the...
Fabregas throwing a pizza at Alex Ferguson. Like, <Yeah. laughs> Well, look, we're not saying football was better, but make up your own mind. Okay, right, you two. We've marked the 17-year anniversary.
We've had our fun. Back to the real...
We'll replay this next year. Come back to us February 1st next year when, naturally, if we're Mark 17, we've got to Mark 18, I think. Ronan Mullen, Arthur Adi, thank you. We have Tom English next, because big Old Firm derby tomorrow. Tom's going to fill us in.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Sky, proud partner and supporter of the Republic of Ireland Women's National Football Team.
This is News Talk.
Now, you're welcome back. So tomorrow evening we have an Old Firm derby, Celtic against Rangers, at a very significant point in the title race as well. 23 games apiece. Rangers are two in front of Celtic, the latter very much deemed the team in form at the moment, and they have home advantage. Very happy to bring in Tom English of BBC Scotland. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Joe.
You're looking forward to a good beating at Murrayfield at the weekend. We won't get into that now, though.
Scotland. You know, everyone in Ireland is talking up Scotland, Joe. It's very, very disconcerting for the Scots.
Yes. We love how they let us down continually.
Everyone over here says, why Irish rugby people hate us so much? This is it's a long story, lads.
I suppose last year, in some respects, is the greatest fourth place finish of all time, given that you won in Paris and London.
Yeah. First time win in London in 38 years. First time winning in Paris in 22 years or something like that. Blew it against Wales. Scotland. Lost by a point, having played the last 20 minutes with 14 men. And deservedly lost to Ireland. So it was close. It was off the crossbar. They're definitely getting better.
So let's turn to matters at hand. Old Firm Derby midweek, which is, I mean, I was trying to rack my brain's recent memory, midweek Old Firm Derby. The last one I could see was 11 years ago at the Shame Game of 2011. Is that what this, am I right?
Oh, God. Yeah, probably. I was at that game, actually. Skin and hair flew after that. In hindsight, when you look back on it, everyone overreacted ridiculously. There was an Act of Parliament passed, Offensive Behaviour at Football Act, passed by the Scottish Government in response to that, which was just such heavy-handed lawmaking. It was ridiculous, and they eventually binned it. But it was in response to that game. Yeah. Gosh, I hope we don't get anything like that. That would be crazy. Either the schmozzles on the pitch or the overzealous politicking in the aftermath.
Yeah. We might grab a picture and throw it up, but that's, from memory, that's McCoist and Lennon squaring up to each other and all that. Mm. El Hadji Diouf was knocking around then as well.
Yeah, he was a charming character, El Hadji Diouf. But it was Lennon and it was McCoist, the respective managers, throwing a few shapes and a bit of pushing and shoving. Mm. It was crazy. The reaction to it. I probably got caught up in it as well. I'd hate to go back and see my stuff, Joe, that I wrote then. I don't think I went into full Shame Game mode, but I was probably a bit bombastic, maybe.
It's funny you mentioned the politicking afterwards. I mean, you could fast forward almost a decade on and look at the politicking on the back of trips to Dubai around COVID time and say that politicians continue to see Scottish football as very easy feasting at times.
Well, they've been inseparable, really, in COVID times, the politics and the football. Football authorities in this country think that the current Scottish government, the SNP, are kind of in some way anti-football. I think it's garbage, quite honestly. But there's an uneasy relationship between football in Scotland and Holyrood, the government in Holyrood in Edinburgh. That's a whole new show, Joe. But I think your listeners would be switching off in their droves if we started to get into Scottish football versus the SNP.
Okay, point taken. So this game was originally January the 2nd, and then there was a vote to take the winter break early, and that's one of the reasons we have this midweek evening game. Is there like a pent-up demand for an evening midweek game for Old Derby Clash, or makes no great odds really either way?
I think an evening game always looks better, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Sounds better than the normal traditional like 12 or half 12 on a Sunday. Mm. This couldn't be any more different. I'm sure the police would be concerned because it's a full house. Rangers allocation is virtually zero. That's the way they do these things nowadays. It's between Celtic and Rangers. It's a tit for tat. They don't kind of tend to allow the other fans into their own stadiums for Old Firm games anymore. But yeah, there is a big sense of anticipation ahead of this. Lots of new players. Title on the line, 2 points between them, both faltering. Neither of them have looked that convincing. Celtic probably have more momentum, but they're still not 100% convincing, although they haven't had their best team on the pitch yet. But they're probably in a marginally better place at the moment. And you know, underpinning all of this is that the probability that whoever wins the league this season is going to go straight into the group stage of the Champions League. That's the way the coefficient, the seedings are working at the moment. So that's like 30 million plus straight into the bank balance, you know. So it's big stuff.
Remind us of the genesis of this tit-for-tat with away fans at Old Firm games.
I think it goes back to fans. I don't know who started it, to be honest. I can't remember. But they cut the allocation down because their own fans were going, well, why are we giving this club 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 tickets when, you know, there's demand for all those tickets for your own season ticket holders and your own people? So I think the allocation was reduced, and then it was reduced again, and then COVID came along. and it changed it again. And it's not looking like Rangers or Celtic are going to turn back the clock on this, because I think the respective fans don't really want them to turn back the clock. If it's 60,000 tomorrow night, which it will be, Celtic fans, a lot of Celtic fans would say, yeah, you know, it'd be nice if there was 6,000 or 7,000 Rangers fans in there, but that means 6,000 or 7,000 of our own people are not getting in. And the feeling is mutual at Ibrox. So I think they're a bit of an impasse there.
Right. Because the neutral in me would say it's a much better atmosphere to have the 6,000 or 7,000 away fans in.
Yes and no. Depends on what the atmosphere is like. Sometimes the atmosphere can be poisonous. Sometimes it can be poisonous. And you think, you know, okay, people kind of talk about the Old Firm derby and the atmosphere and all this. Well, if they're singing some of the songs, some of the stuff that they're singing, then you can kind of do without, or at least I can. But it does take away, there's no question, it does take away from the kind of gladiatorial aspect to the Old Firm, which made it a pretty special derby in the first place. We're not allowed to call it the Old Firm anymore, Joe, by the way. That's gone. Celtic fans get up in arms when you call it the Old Firm nowadays.
Sorry, I didn't realize.
It's called the Glasgow Derby now. Okay. Or at least that's what Celtic fans, a lot of Celtic fans, not all of them. It's a bit, again, excuse me, it's a bit of the pantomime of the rivalry between Celtic and Rangers.
Explain that to me. So since I've been a young football fan, I've called it the Old Firm Derby without ever even questioning what the Old Firm means. It's just what I call it. So why is that offensive?
Well, some Celtic fans will say, and I don't want to get myself into trouble here, but they will say that in 2012 when Rangers went bust, and you're talking about administration there and liquidation, they would argue that this Rangers is not the same as...
Ah, for God's sake. Okay, well, I'm calling it the Old Firm.
There you go.
Jeez, come on.
I call it the Old Firm as well.
I thought there was a more genuine reason than that nonsense. Right, well...
Well, you know, what's your timeline, Joe? What's your timeline?
It's fine. Look, my favourite button in the world is the mute button, Tom. You know?
Yeah, join the club. Try block. I've become an indiscriminate blocker these days on Twitter.
Like, I take the point about what happened at Rangers, but they still play at Ibrox. It's still the same fan base. I don't think it's a good enough reason to throw out calling it the Old Firm Derby, which is, you know, has global appeal. Like, let's not shoot yourself in the foot either.
I think there's an element of some Celtic fans winding up the Rangers fans by doing this. Some would absolutely believe it. Absolutely believe it. Others would just go along with it because it knows it gets under their skin.
Okay. So
that's all the fun of the fair.
Let's talk about the two respective managers then. Ange Postecoglou has come in. Initially, there were raised eyebrows on who is this guy, and Celtic lost 3 of their first league games this season, but subsequently have won 14 of 17, 3 draws in there as well. And genuinely reading various observers, from Kenny Dalglish to others who are, you know, on the ground week to week, people are very impressed with the job Postecoglou has done. His recruitment, it seems, has been top class. So give us your view on Ange Postecoglou this season.
Really, really, really good. Really refreshing. Very honest, very straight talking. You know, since the disaster of last season for Celtic, it's a total rebuild. It's probably the biggest rebuild of a team at Celtic since the war, maybe. I mean, Martin O'Neill, when he came in, had a big rebuild. This is a much bigger rebuild than Martin O'Neill's rebuild. There's a couple of the team that's going to start. Well, say the Celtic's best team right now, what I consider to be best team right now, there's probably only 2 guys in that team that were there last season. So it's a total rebuild. He has an energy about him. He signed extremely well by the looks of it. Not just in terms of the quality of player he's brought in, but he's got them at relative buttons. The team is playing well. They've won a cup already. They've won the first cup of the season, the League Cup. They've closed the gap on Rangers. And I think everyone just likes, all the Celtic fans just like the look of Postecoglou, the way he wants his team to play. The fact he's a bit different. He's done very, very well. breath of fresh air, really.
Anytime I see him speak, he has a natural authority, I would say. So when you say a bit different, you might expand on that for us.
Well, you know, he speaks extremely well.
Mm.
And he will answer a question directly. He just won't give you a kind of a stock answer. But you want to be, as a journalist, you want to be on your game, because he will throw it back at you, saying, you know, mate, you know, that's a bit of a stupid question. You know, he'll give it to you, and that's great. I think that's brilliant. He asks a stupid question, then fine. And I think just the way he talks about the game, the way he brought in Kyogo Furuhashi, he spent proper money on him, close to $4 million. But he's been amazing. He's been extraordinary for Celtic. He's injured. Unfortunately, won't be playing tomorrow night. In January, he brought in three more Japanese players. So he's tapping into that market. And all three of them look really good. It's early days, but the three of them look very, very good. And it's just the way he kind of thinks differently. It would have been easy, you know, for example, when Eddie Howe was linked, and they had a, for month upon month, they pursued Eddie Howe as the successor to Neil Lennon in the summer. And the rumors coming through about the type of player that Eddie Howe looking at was just guys from lower reaches of the Premier League in England. Familiar guys, solid players. Postecoglou comes in and he immediately signs Kyogo Furuhashi from Japan. he signs Abada, Liel Abada, who's been very good, 20-year-old right winger, very, very good. He signs Jota on loan from Portugal. Excellent. Just different. You know, he's throwing different thinking at it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's working. I mean, the guy, as far as Celtic fans are concerned, the guy walks on water. And he's very open. He talks about his father a lot. That does help. His father, he idolizes his father, and he's opened up in that kind of personal way. He's kind of let the fans into his world, what it was like for him growing up, the principles that his father instilled in him. I mean, he's been very, very, very open and very impressive.
Yeah. Tell us more about his father then. What does he say about him?
Well, his love of football came from his father. The way the game should be played came from his father. He seems to do everything. Listen, I don't want to be a pop psychologist here, but he obviously has had a huge love for his father, and huge love for his father, and learned so much from him, and spoken quite emotionally about his dad, you know. So that plays very well. His father was obviously a big football fan and knew a lot about the game, and he brought up his son to play in a certain way, and he talks about the values, not just football values, but values as a person that were bred into him. And Celtic fans love all that. I mean, all football fans love that kind of honesty and his willingness to invite people into his world, not just his football world, but his life.
And so how does Postecoglou see the game, and how does he think it should be played?
Attacking high intensity football. He said it before. They train the way they play. And there is, in the initial stages, there is a kind of an attritional count in terms of injuries. And there has been. They've had an awful run of injuries.
Mm.
In part probably because of bad luck. In part because he's demanding. He keeps saying this, I demand an awful lot of my players. So I think he does. His training is very, very intense. He wants his team to play incredibly high tempo, high press, aggressive, and then when they get the ball, play. White wingers, and he's brought in, you know, with Furuhashi, he picks just wonderful lines that he runs, brilliant finisher, the two white boys, Jota on the left, Abada on the right, very creative players, very dynamic players, very quick, just likes to play it quick. And that's kind of, again, you go back to what Celtic fans would call the Celtic way, the way Jock Steen used to set up his team back in the day. it's that the kind of Celtic way. They would try and win with a bit of style. Not just 1-0, grind it out. Try and be a bit more, try and aspire to way more than that.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Postecoglou was trying to do.
Further to your point on Abada, he scored the winner at the weekend against Dundee, a late winner in a 1-0 win, whereas Rangers drew 3-0 at Ross County to open the door here for Celtic to overtake Rangers, which is what makes tomorrow so enticing, I think, for lots of people who are going to tune in midweek game. It's going to have a really big audience, this game, I would think. You mentioned all those signings, Jota and Abada and the others who've hit the ground running. By Scottish terms, has Postecoglou spent a huge amount of money here, or has he done this on a pretty good budget?
He's done it on a good budget. And they've spent, like, he's got the three Japanese lads that came in January. Hatate looks a lovely footballer.
He's in midfield.
They've been playing him left side in midfield.
Okay.
He can play left back. He can play left wing back. He's a versatile player. He can come into the middle. Looks like he can play. He's just a lovely footballer. You know, one of those guys you can feel he can play anywhere. Indiguchi is more defensive midfielder. And Maeda, who's with Japan at the moment and who they're hoping will be back in time for the game tomorrow night to play some part, he's a centre forward. Now, or he can play wide as well of the three. He likes to play 4-3-3, Postecoglou. So those three guys, those four Japanese guys now, have kind of lit the place up. And it's very interesting, you know, he's got them for... He spent proper money on Furuhashi, knocking on for 4 million. He spent less than 1 million on Udoguchi. He spent, Hatate is about 1.4, and Maeda is probably a bit less than that. So you're never quite sure what the numbers involve, but cheap. Cheap. In fact, one of the Japanese journalists said at the time that it's you know, fair play to Celtic. They've taken these players, these three players, but they're guilty of daylight robbery, you know, because two of them were in the team of the year in Japan last season. Maeda and Hatate were in the team of the year. So he's resourced that market. He hasn't spent a lot of money. I mean, Celtic sold Christopher Eyer to Brentford. They sold Edward to Crystal Palace. And they sold one other player for proper money, whose name escapes me now. But all of those have funded more or less what everything that Postecoglou has spent. So he's done really good business, particularly since Celtic, for the last couple of seasons in the transfer market, have been a bomb scare. They've been terrible. Panic buys, panic loan buys. A very high failure rate. Postecoglou's come in, and most of the guys he's brought in, the big ticket items, have been a big success.
Okay, very interesting. So Stephen Gerrard's bedding in very well at Aston Villa. How is Giovanni Van Bronckhorst bedding in at Rangers?
Started off very well. He inherited a team, obviously, that were the champions, but had kind of fallen away a little bit, even though they were still on top of the league. The performance levels weren't of a very high order. Defence suddenly had looked vulnerable. So he came in, and in his early games, he fixed that. Defence immediately looked solid. Gerrard liked to play with his two fullbacks very, very attacking. Barisic on the left and Tavernier on the right. Nathan Patterson also on the right, who's obviously now at Everton. They were used to bomb along, and they used to score goals, and particularly Tavernier, and create an awful lot. Van Bronckhorst has been a little bit more circumspect in terms of his fullbacks, get them to drop a bit deeper, defend more often, and that was working. Lately, they've looked flaky at the back again, particularly against Ross County at the weekend. Alan McGregor, who's now 40 years of age, an absolute veteran, has been a brilliant, brilliant player for them and was exceptional in goal last season, started to make a few mistakes. Conor Goldson has made a few mistakes. Glenn Kamara has made a few mistakes. So it's the spine of the team. It's the goalkeeper, the centre half, and the defensive midfielder are making the kind of mistakes that didn't make last season at all, really, domestically, or at least in the league. So they look even though they're still 2 points in the lead, they're not what they were last season. And people will say, well, you can't be because they were unbeaten throughout the league season last season, and fair play. But certainly Celtic have moved up considerably. But I would say Rangers have moved back a tad as well to narrow that gap.
Mm. One signing which caught the eye, obviously, yesterday was Aaron Ramsey at 31 years of age. Still very good age. On a six-month loan deal to Rangers. He hasn't played in Serie A since October, so I would think with a view to the World Cup, amongst other things, he wants first-team football. He said, I had a number of offers on the table. None matched the magnitude of this club, European football, the chance to play in front of 50,000 fans every other week. I'm not sure who's paying his wages or what's going on there, but he's certainly high-profile signing, the kind that you wouldn't associate with Scottish football of late, I would think.
No, he's certainly probably the most high profile in terms of kind of players of that stature coming into Scottish football. You go back to Roy Keane and Robbie Keane coming in, that type.
Yeah.
Massive, huge. There was rumours last season, Joe, that Rangers were interested in him. And kind of people dismissed it as, you know, paper talk, tabloids getting excited. But clearly there was something in it because they've done the deal now. Rangers say they haven't broken their wage structure. So Juventus are picking up the vast, vast majority of his salary on this. I don't know what Rangers are paying. I would imagine that their top whack weekly salary would be in the region of 30-ish. So he's probably on something of that order. From them, Juventus will be paying the rest. But it's a signing that has absolutely thrilled the Rangers fans, as you can imagine. He won't be playing tomorrow night. He's not ready. But he's the type that they need. That creative midfielder, goal scorer, creator, glamorous. And it's you know, you could say, oh, well, it's short-termism till the end of the season. But you go back to that probable automatic spot in the Champions League. And both of these teams will do whatever they can to win the league and claim that spot. Not just for the money, but obviously for the glamour of group stage Champions League football. And it's been a while since Rangers or Celtic have had one of those. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be very, very interesting to see what Ramsey does.
Yeah, for sure. Just a kind of top of the head question, the Scottish League and its place within Scottish football and the public's general interest in it, I'm wondering, is that diluted for the younger generation who are hitting their teens and 20s now? Because there was obviously a time going way back when to, you know, those Leeds Rangers games and the Battle of Britain, and even into Martin O'Neill's time at Celtic when they're making serious forays into Europe and winning at the San Siro, where, you know, the quality was very, very, very respectable. And increasingly over time, money is what it is. I mean, you're talking about £4 million as, you know, serious cash for a player. I mean, in the Premier League, that'd be laughable by comparison. So the comparative drop in quality is one thing. And also demographics have shifted in that right around the world, not least here, I think a lot of kids, they don't necessarily support a team, they support Messi. And they've gone from wearing Barcelona jerseys to PSG jerseys, and they support Ronaldo, and they'll follow him around. That's been an aspect of how fans support teams. So I wonder if all of those various things have come together to make Scottish football less engrossing for the younger generation. Are they leaning more towards Premier League? Are they leaning more towards the superstars? Do you see more of those jerseys around Glasgow or beyond? Or is Scottish football still very much the main attraction for the younger fans?
Look, you'll see Barcelona jerseys, and you'll see, you know, some of the English jerseys knocking about the place. But largely, you'll see Scottish football jerseys. It's very robust, Joe, Scottish football. I mean, say what you like about it. And it is intoxicating. You know, and I speak as an Irishman, it does get under your skin. There's something about it. I think it matters so much whether you're talking to a Rangers fan or a Celtic fan or a Hearts, Hibs, Aberdeen, Dundee United, whoever, St Johnstone, it doesn't matter. The passion that they have for their club is incredible. Mm. It's like a local GAA parish stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it's like. And the fans, they are so loyal. And most of them can never hope, even hope to see their team winning a trophy. You know, it's going to be Celtic and Rangers most of the time, or at least Celtic. It has been Celtic monopolizing the trophies until last season. But when that little bit of magic happens, St Johnstone win the League Cup and the Scottish Cup last season. Incredible. Incredible. And I think there is, and I don't want to get too pious about this, but I think there is an honesty about Scottish football. The fact that it isn't awash with money.
Mm.
The fact that they have to, all those clubs have to work their backsides off in their communities to get the fans through the gates, and all of them work incredibly hard. Nothing comes easy for these clubs because they're on the breadline, you know, a lot of them.
Mm.
And they work really, really hard. And I think that gives it an integrity. I mean, I spent 3 hours with Partick Thistle's manager a couple of weeks ago, Ian McCall. And to see the work that he does and his small team around him do, not just in the football club, but in the community, is incredible. And that's replicated all over the place. Really good people working hard. It's the only thing I can compare it to is GAA clubs, hurling and football clubs up and down Ireland. And they are as important, the football teams in Scotland are as important as those hurling and football teams are in Ireland in parish life. And that endures. It survived. Everyone, when COVID came and there's no money in Scottish football, relatively speaking, and the governance of the game could be a whole lot better from the top. But when COVID came, there was an awful lot of talk about Armageddon. This could kill off a lot of these small clubs, these community clubs, because they need punters through the gates and they weren't getting them and football was suspended. They all endured. They all did what they had to do. And the communities helped them. You know, the communities, they said, well, I know I've paid for my season ticket and I know there's no football to watch, but it's fine. Keep the money. You don't have to reimburse me. And what can we do to help out? Is there anything we can do to come and help the club?
Mm.
I mean, great stories. Really, really heartwarming stories. Maybe you get that down in the Premier League in England, but, you know, certainly you get it here.
That's really interesting. Oh God, in some ways, the picture you painted there is the perfect blend, because here in Ireland, with the League of Ireland clubs, it's not under people's skin. GAA is very much about your sense of place. And that indoctrination almost that you're talking about, which gives the Scottish League the robustness, that's not there with League of Ireland clubs around the country. There aren't enough clubs. You know, there's too many in Dublin. There's not enough in other counties around the country. So we're not quite there, nor is it successful enough to be in the Champions League too often, realistically. And then at the other end of the spectrum, the Premier League is now this corporate, hollow, sanitised monster which feels further and further adrift from people in the streets. So actually, God, when you paint it that way, maybe you have the perfect blend, actually, of quality and infrastructure with a certain a realness.
There's a realness. And, you know, the owners, the chief executives, they're visible here. Most of them. Not all of them, but most of them. A lot of them are on Twitter. a lot of them engage with their fans all the time. And I think that's an awful lot to be commended on that. You know, I think Scottish football, it can be a bit of a punch bag if people can be bothered throwing a punch. But there's an awful lot of good in it. I am definitely a champion of it. I know it's false. It's many, many faults. And whenever the notion of Celtic and Rangers moving down to England is drummed up, and it's always rubbish, really. There's never anything in it. I always think, right, okay, what's going to happen? Say Celtic and Rangers go and join the Premier League or work their way up from lower leagues into the Premier League. They're both massive, massive institutions. So foreign owners, absolutely ripe for the picking, Celtic and Rangers, ripe for the picking. Immediately, the fabric of those clubs changes. It just changes, like Man United has changed, like Man City has changed. And maybe a lot of people would say for the better, a lot of people would say for the worse. I would hate to see Celtic and Rangers leave. And I know both of them at various times would say, oh, we need to leave to progress. I understand that. I get that. But I think the fabric of those, be careful what you wish for, would be my point. I think they could end up with a club that they don't recognise anymore.
Yes, the Saudi PIF could swoop in and then you have all sorts of issues. Yes. Listen, that was fascinating. So, Old Firm Derby. Sorry, God, I'm not trolling anyone by saying that. It's just the Old Firm Derby to me and that's the way it is. Old Firm Derby
you
tomorrow.
Said it. You said it, Joe.
Glasgow Derby, whatever. Celtic against Rangers. God, can I say anything? Tom English of BBC Scotland. Thanks so much, Tom. Appreciate it.
Cheers, Joe.
You've worked hard to build your brand, so why settle for one-size-all-fits branded clothing? Lands' End Outfitters creates apparel your employees will truly want to wear, all backed by above and beyond expertise. See why Lands' End Outfitters has been a branded apparel supplier to some of the world's most respected brands for more than 30 years. Go to business.landsend.com/pod20 and use code pod20 for 20% off your first product. That's business.landsend.com/pod20, code pod20, for 20% off your first product.